Every day, CT testifies to the reality that Jesus is alive, transforming his world and bringing his kingdom to bear. Jesus transforms, CT equips. Make a gift to our nonprofit ministry with a gift of $20 to provide 150 more people with redemptive storytelling, global perspective, and thoughtful podcasts. Give now at morect.com/equip.
This episode is brought to you by Our Daily Bread Ministries, a global media organization that makes the life-changing wisdom of the Bible understandable and accessible to all. Visit whereyourfrom.org for more information. That's whereyafrom.org.
This is CT Media.
Welcome to Being Human with Steve Cuss. I'm glad to be with you guys today. And I'm really excited to welcome to the podcast two precious people to me who are artists, among other things. Before I introduce who it is and get to the interview, I just want to say, for me, a profound part of being a human being is the absolute gift of music. My theology is that God made us human, which means that we carry the image of God with us. We bear God's image. And there's some unique privileges to that that we have that other species don't have. And as I think about it, one of them for me is we have the capacity to be moved by beauty. And I find music to be beautiful and profoundly moving. I play music. I'm not really an artist at all. I love to play. I love to sing, and I'm not a good singer, but I enjoy singing. I love to play guitar. I love the sound of a stringed instrument. So part of my life-giving habit, part of the way I relax into God's presence, is I try to play a piece of music every day if I can. And I also try to intentionally listen to music every day because I'm a human, because other species don't get that. Like if you notice like a cat, for example, I've never seen a cat stop and listen to Mozart. But I can put on a tune by like Patty Griffin or David Gray. I can be moved. I can be thinking about the words or the mood that it put me in for the rest of the day. So I love art. And these artists that I'm introducing today, Andy Gellerhorn and Jill Phillips, many of you already know them. They're very well known as singer-songwriters in Nashville. Andy, I'm really thrilled that he actually wrote a custom piece of music for this podcast. So you've already heard some of his guitar playing on previous episodes. But they're singer-songwriters in Nashville that have just been faithfully doing amazing work for 25, 30 years now. Jill's interesting because a few years ago, she went back to school and got her master's in mental health counseling. She's a therapist in Nashville. So they're both touring musicians. Jill's a therapist. And Andy also has a unique healing ministry. I like all kinds of music, but I would describe their music as profoundly healing. When I listen to it, I find myself in it. So before we get to the interview, just want you to know in the show notes of the podcast, I've actually put some links to some of their music that has meant a lot to me. I'm just going to encourage you as you go about your day, as the interview ends, maybe you'll click on those links and take a listen for yourself. And hopefully it'll move you the way it's moved me. All right. So here's our candle. Let's light it together as we relax into God's presence, as we give thanks for the gift of art. Let me just take some silence. We just notice what's going on in us. We name it and give it to God. And then we do what we can to relax into God's presence. Here's my conversation with Andy and Jill. So Andy and Jill, I was listening to an interview with Lyle Lovett. Many people know I'm a big fan of him and his music. Andy, of course, fellow Texan, mm-hmm. which we have to appreciate. He said something about music that really set me up. Since I've heard it, I've not stopped thinking about it. So I want to share the quote with you in two parts and get your reaction. Here's the first part. Lyle says, "Music is the only art form that joins your existing life. All other art requires you to stop what you're doing, like reading a book or looking at a painting. You have to put your life on hold while you read that book or look at a painting. But you can listen to music while driving or on a road trip or chopping veggies for dinner." Hmm. That's the first half of the quote. I would love to get your reaction to that.
Wow. I've never heard anybody say that before.
I haven't either.
My first thought, honestly, was like, that's true, except for me, it's hard for me to multitask with music, but the whole rest of my family can do that. So I know that that's true. And that makes music feel like more of a companion. I like that quote.
I do too. I was thinking about Albert Borgman's work around like focal practices, and he was sort of differentiating listening to music and the gift of that versus actually playing. There's a different level of focus when you're having to stop and just like play an instrument. And so I like both. It is really different when I'm listening to music when I'm making dinner versus when I'm like doing a show.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder if things in music can slip in and impact us in a different way, because maybe our guard is down more if we're just doing the dishes and listening to music, and it can kind of sneak past some barriers. I hope that's true.
Well, let me try the second half and see how this grabs you. Lyle then goes on to say, because music joins your existing life, the greatest compliment a songwriter can receive is, "I know exactly where I was when I first heard that song," or "I know exactly what I was doing when I first heard that song." How does that strike you guys?
It touches on, to me, what I think is so magical and healing about music is that it can, I just love the idea of it meeting us where we are. Somebody else's story finding its way through some airwaves and then landing with somebody. And as a songwriter, I think that's just like probably one of my biggest hopes and dreams for a song is that it might be able to meet somebody right where they are and have an impact on them and make them feel less alone in that moment.
Yeah, and when it's maybe not even what you wrote it about, but it's meaning something very unique in their story, it's so beautiful. It just speaks to the bigger nature of music, that it's really just bigger than all of us.
Hmm. Okay, so each of you are songwriters. You've written your own songs, you've written together, you've performed for decades. What would be just one song from each of you that people have said the most, "I remember where I was when I first heard it," or one song from each of you that you hear again and again has had a profound impact on people?
I mean, I think for me, it's one of my oldest songs. It's called "I Am." And I hear more about that song probably than anything. I think it's because it's a song of comfort, and it's a song of sort of just God's peace being sung over somebody and his promises. And I mean, I just think, well, who doesn't need to hear that? Lately, it's been "Bright Sadness." Again, they're songs of comfort in suffering or in pain. What are they for you?
Well, there's a song called "Brave One" that I wrote for a friend who was dying of cancer. And then a song called "Grand Canyon," which is also kind of about pretty serious grief. I think those are maybe the two that I hear the most about hitting people in that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, none of the happy songs.
That's interesting. I was thinking same for me.
Yeah, and Andy, you write some wickedly funny songs, but I guess people like comment on them, but they don't say, "Oh, that moved me tremendously." Is that right?
Yeah, I'll probably hear more about those. Like at a show, that's what people would remember. They're like, "Oh, that's the guy that sang the song about whatever stupid thing I sang the song about," more than something serious that I sang. But I don't know if it's the same kind of hitting in the same place where they remember the first time they heard it.
And I think they go hand in hand to me. The laughter opens up the door of your heart, and then all of a sudden you can receive this other message. And I think he does that really well.
Yeah, I first encountered your guys' work almost 20 years ago now. When I'm in a concert of yours, there's a safety and a feeling of being seen. How would you guys describe your ministry of music?
A word that I think of as small. We've played all kinds of places, and probably when we both started, there were probably dreams for these big things to happen. But then realizing that the kind of songs that we want to write would be specific to our lives, and the songs have kind of found their way into those comfortable places, which are like more small and intimate. And then that small intimate spaces then kind of inform the new songs that come out. It's like a feedback loop there. So the Venn diagram of what we love and then like the songs that we write, there's a lot of overlap. And I think there's a core message of wanting people to feel loved and accepted where they are and not alone. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, important to us outside of music. So there ends up being kind of a therapeutic element to it, partly because we've been through a lot of therapy and also partly because one of us is a therapist and it's not me.
Well, I was going to say too, I cannot remember who said this quote, but it just came to mind. It was years ago, but they were saying there's two kinds of performing. There's a person who gets up and is like, hey, this is why you're paying to see me. I'm special. I'm different. And then there's a kind of performing that's like very collaborative. Like, this is why we're all in this together. I've always felt that I resonated with the second one.
Yeah. I think what you do is you give room for the ache that is part of being a human. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that? I'm kind of making this up in real time, but I think that's another thing that you guys do that other singer-songwriters I really appreciate do.
That's what I would dream that people would feel. And it's always kind of music that my heart was always drawn to. It's like people
Me
that
too.
Are writing out of their own experience.
Yeah.
And where the language is somewhat conversational, where you feel like the evening is more of a conversation than a presentation, even though it really is a one-way conversation because I'm the only one with a microphone.
But I would say something that is important to us is really being in collaboration with the audience, like sensing who's in the room, sensing the energy, sensing like what the event is, what the context is, not just coming in with the set list that's just right. Like, this is what we do. It's like, we want to be in service of what's happening in the room. So it's a dance. Mm.
What would you say to a young artist who is wanting to begin doing public work? What are their first couple of moves to begin doing that?
I'm always going to start with being connected to some sort of community. What I've seen in the many years we've been doing this, and I see this in my life, I see it in my practice, is this life can be very lonely. If you have any sort of traction with it, whatever that looks like, even if it's locally, you're going to be in a very performance-based culture of people that don't really know you, but know you're outside. A lot of people crash and burn and just don't make it that long. So you need your people that are going to know you, be checking in with you, that aren't so impressed by everything you do. I think that was a really important thing that we did. And then, of course, from the artistic standpoint, getting better at your craft, listening to people that you love, and the relational component. I said like three things, but there's a servant nature to what you're doing and treating the people well that you interact with. That stuff goes so far.
If the goal is just to make as much money and get as much popularity as you can, like within 2 to 5 years, then don't worry about the community and
yeah.
don't worry about treating people nicely and just strike while the iron's hot and just
totally.
Do as much as you can and act like you're a big deal and then people will believe that you're a big deal. But if you're interested in doing this for a long period of time, I think the smartest thing that we did early on in our career is that we just decided we were going to go to a local church with a lot of old people in it and then to show up during the week because we were traveling on weekends. Investing in a stable community that was kind of outside of the music world here, that has paid more dividends than any other decision I think we've made.
It's still our community.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you guys have been doing good quality, quiet work for a long time. And there's something about that, isn't there, that longevity also is part of quality? Hmm.
I think Andy and I both felt so much more validated in what we felt called to do spending time with Eugene Peterson. He really modeled for us through several retreats we did together what it is like to have that long obedience in the same direction and what it was like to be faithful in the small things. Because, you know, he never pastored a mega church. He started writing the message really for his congregation, not to be a bestseller. That was just so validating. And I do think there's something about just being in it for a long time and deepening in your awareness of what it is that you're called to do and what it is that you're not, and being fine with that. And, you know, if someone asks us to do something that we feel like is not really our gifting, it's a joy to be like, oh my gosh, you should call this person. This person is great at that, but this is kind of what we do well. You need like an outdoor show, you know, like, it's like, like Andy's kryptonite. We have the people for you. If you want an inside show with like singer-songwriters, word-based, like we're your people.
And you'd think that we've been doing this for 26 years or something like that. Still, whenever I go play a show, 98% of the people have never heard of me before. There might have been a season in my life where I was like, oh, that's such a bummer. But thanks to people like Eugene Peterson, I kind of love that. When we came to Nashville to go to Belmont University, I never thought that there was a way that you could make a living and have a career over a long period of time if you weren't Garth Brooks or the top producer. But the truth is there is a lot of space for people who want to connect with whatever it is that we do.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for that. I just never even knew that was an option. And somehow we're still doing it. But when we did spend time with Eugene, it wasn't like that idea of doing stuff small was a new idea for us. We just always felt like that's just kind of what happened. And hearing him talk and reading his book, The Pastor, especially, it just validated that experience. It's like, oh, this experience feels valid. But when you get on an airplane and people are like, oh, have I heard you before? And you're like, no, you haven't. In that world, you feel like, oh, I guess it doesn't matter.
I guess we should be trying harder.
Yeah. And Eugene was just like, no, it matters. If it's one person, then it matters. And maybe every year I believe it a little bit more.
There are so many ways to do this and have it be meaningful and faithful. It doesn't have to be the traditional, I get a record deal kind of way. It can be you're working in your local church. The people in your congregation and your community are singing your songs. Or you live in Texas and all you ever do is tour Texas. I mean, that is valid and meaningful.
God is a genius storyteller, and the evidence of this is threaded throughout Scripture. In Christianity Today's new show, Holy Curiosity, with me, Kat Armstrong, we explore storied connections threaded throughout Scripture from the Old Testament to the New. Our first mini-series, Connecting Dinah and the Woman at the Well, welcomes experts like Drs. Tim Mackey and Diane Landberg to give us insight and context into the physical location and meaning of these two stories. These stories will spark holy curiosity in your own faith, because once you see these connections, you can't unsee them. God wastes no person, place, or thing. Listen and subscribe to Holy Curiosity with Kat Armstrong on your favorite podcast platform.
For those who don't know, Jill, you now have a practice in Nashville.
I do.
As well as your music career.
Yes.
Andy, you're still doing healing retreats. When Lisa and I hosted a conference, we knew you were the ones we wanted to bring the music because of your emphasis and appreciation of emotional health. I'm famous for my long questions, but you are in a lot of churches. What are you seeing in churches today that encourage you as it relates to emotional well-being and mental health?
Well, Steve, I'm not just saying this because we're on your podcast, but the truth is your conference was one of my favorite events last year.
Oh, really? I'm glad to hear that.
It was just so wonderful. Mm-hmm. You guys curated such a safe, encouraging environment for people to come and be themselves and learn and grow and be vulnerable. That is one of the things that encourages me, is I'm seeing churches value mental health. And I'm personally seeing a lot of churches pay for people's therapy, which is incredible to me because the financial piece is usually such a barrier for so many people. I was just asked to come and speak at a church about mental health. They're trying to work with local therapists to take the stigma away for some of their congregation. I'm also seeing churches refer things out that they know are outside of their wheelhouse, which I think is beautiful. I'm really encouraged by a lot of that. What about you?
Andy, I can feel you chomping at the bit for the other side of the question.
I was like, what do you want to say?
Yeah, what do you want to say? What do you see that either gives you alarm or... I mean, I'll go first. I think one of the downsides is, as we use more emotional health language, if our posture hasn't shifted, sometimes we end up then wielding emotional health language rather than creating a safe space. I've seen that, for example.
Yeah.
What would you add, Andy? And then Jill, what would you add?
Yeah, I think a lot of this is like two sides of the same coin, where like the very thing that's great about it depending on the culture of the church and the people that are involved, it could also be a hard thing about it. I think of a couple of things. One is a friend, theologian Brad Jerzak, we were talking about programs like Celebrate Recovery in churches and how wonderful it is that people who are struggling with addictions can have a place to go inside the church. And he would say sometimes those programs, since they are part of a program from a church, sometimes they smuggle in a retributive God. So part of the healing process is really taking a hard look at who you really think God is. Like practically, this is what you're talking about all the time, a lived theology. And sometimes in certain churches, the desire to be open and a safe place is there, but some of the theology underneath it doesn't support that. I've been seeing a lot of situations of when people make mistakes in church discipline, which I understand, sometimes the church discipline, when you're talking about mental health or you're talking about things like shame, to separate somebody from their community until they get better, it's a hard thing to do because you don't understand what that's doing to their shame and then how that's playing in with it. So for some places, it's so new that it's going to be kind of clunky the way that it's experienced.
Well, especially, I mean, I think it's profound what you said about the theology undergirding the program. I mean, that's going to linger with me for quite a while to think about that. I'm familiar with Celebrate Recovery. I know it's helped a lot of people.
Yeah.
I also know a lot of people in AA who would say there's something magical about the church basement, the idea that we never require you to choose your higher power, whereas the Celebrate Recovery, there's not an option. So it is a nuanced thing, I think.
And I'm not bashing Celebrate Recovery. It's a great program and it's really helped a lot of people. It's more of that if there's part of your healing that needs to go all the way down to the studs, to the level where you're like, this God who I think I've been worshiping, how I experience him is not actually who he says he is. You kind of need to be at a place where you're free to tear it all down as much as you want to tear it down. And that's just a hard thing to do in some church structures because it's like, oh, well, if you tear it down, then you're going to leave the church. We're worried about you leaving the church, and that's a big concern. It's hard finding that space where it's totally safe to do whatever needs to happen for somebody's healing.
Yeah.
I would just love to see more integration of these things rather than these things siloed. I know some church leaders I talk to are very suspicious of therapy and therapists because they think they're going to take people away from their faith. When really, it typically frees people to experience faith like we heard Jesus talking about. So yeah, I think there's just a need for all of those spaces and places and for them to be working together and feeding into each other rather than there's this over here and there's this over here. That's my hope.
Yeah. So then if we stick on this conversation, the next question, it may be redundant, but I think we may be able to pull a little more out of this. It's like, okay, if each of you could stop a specific practice that's happening in the church that's well-meaning but damaging, what would it be? I'll happily go first. I still find even in my own life, underneath my ability to be a safe space and listen to people is a core belief that I have to make someone feel better. And what ends up happening is if my shock absorbers are a little worn out, if I'm not on my best game, I hit that core belief as someone sharing their pain. I think I'm being helpful, but I then prescribe a scripture or some Christian version of, it's not that bad, look on the bright side. Mm-hmm. It's very humbling for me. I mean, I used to be a trauma chaplain where there was no room for that. And yet I find 28 years into my vocation, that's what I'm still working on, is my capacity to sit with people in pain without feeling a need to defend God or to give them another view, as if somehow that's helpful when it's always just to help me. It's never to help them. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing I wish I could take away. And I see it everywhere in churches. I think as a pastor, I have a particular empathy for pastors because I know the pressure we feel to make people better. So I kind of get it, but I also see my colleagues doing this nonstop. I know it's not helpful. What might be one that you guys would want to do away with?
We played at church services a lot over the last 25 years. We don't do it as much anymore because we try to be home at our own church. But you're coming to play music or before a sermon or before, you know, whatever it is, there's so much emphasis put on like, make sure there's no dead time. Prayer for years meant when there's public prayer, that means it's our time to move and plug in. It's a transitional moment. So you pray as long as you need to transition. I'm not saying there's something wrong with that, but I am saying that I think it is indicating that we're not okay sometimes with silence. and space. The idea of not having the right answer or not having the fix, but just being able to just be silent together. I just know that when I'm in a corporate setting and everyone is like, you know what, instead of me trying to say a prayer for 3 minutes with the most names of God in it that I can think of, let's be silent together. And that is so countercultural and it's so meaningful to me personally. Maybe it's not meaningful to everybody else, but it just feels like such a vulnerable place to have that kind of silence together. I kind of wish that there's more of that built into corporate worship in general.
I have run into more than my fair share of hosts on the stage that they're so anxious about giving a time of silence, they speak through most of it.
It brings up a lot of anxiety, silence in a room with a lot of people, for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe this is covering kind of what y'all are all talking about, but I love seeing like a robust theology of suffering in churches. I think a lot of people do not have a good theology around suffering. There's still this sense, you know, with that old punitive God that you're talking about, that if something bad is happening to you, you've done something wrong. And I see that with people all the time, that their view of God is somewhere deep down, that if hard things are happening to you, it's because you did not do something right. If your kids are struggling, it's because you are a bad mom. Or if you're having doubts about God, it's because you are not doing X, Y, and Z. And so I think what has been really healing for me and the people I sit with and the people I love is really normalizing suffering and struggle as a part of the human journey, as a part of following Jesus and being faithful. Our pastor, Thomas McKenzie, who passed away several years ago, who just meant the world to us, he always said, in the Christian life, it's a feature and not a bug. And I have just come back to that over and over again. So I think that normalization of it as a community is just really important for people who find themselves in that place.
Well, Jill and Andy, we've covered a wide variety of topics, but inevitably, it's unavoidable. It's time for you to endure with glee the gauntlet of anxiety.
Oh my
Jill,
gosh.
You were just talking about the feature, not a bug. I've heard the gauntlet of anxiety described as 50% proctological exam, 50% roller coaster. We'll see how it is for you guys.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
Five questions. I'll throw the questions rapid fire or at least short answers and just one and then the other.
Okay.
Question number one, Andy, let's start with you. How do you know when you're not well?
I start doing a whole lot of unproductive doing, things that don't necessarily need to be done right then.
Jill?
I'm up in my head and I'm trying to control things.
Okay. We all get triggered by personality or behavioral types in other people. We get irritable or anger. What is a guaranteed behavior or personality trait in someone else that is absolutely going to trigger you into irritability or anger?
Will you answer that, OTG?
Oh, man. Deplaning before it's your turn. We've talked about this, Steve. Anyway, there's good reasons for that sometimes, but just pushing in front of other people as if other people don't matter.
Yeah, when people are elevating themselves above other people. Not that that's all coming from a good place in me. That probably just pricks my own shame. So that's something that does it.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by reactivity because it's always built on a false need, not something that's true. So for me, people's approval is a guarantee. I can sit here with you guys right now and very soberly say I don't need someone's approval, but then you could watch me when someone's in front of me and suddenly I'm acting like a golden retriever. So what's something that you think you need that you don't actually need?
I'm going to say for me, knowing what's to come. That has been my work, is realizing that I can trust myself and God and me, whatever comes. I don't need to know what it is.
I guess for me, it would be thinking that I need both to not be affected by something, but also to not to affect, be a zero-sum game as a person.
Okay. One thing that I'm wanting to hear more conversation about in the church is the gap between our belief in God and our experience with God. Where would be a gap in your faith right now? Something that you believe about God that you struggle to see or struggle to experience?
I wouldn't say it's all the time, because I've really had to wrestle with this over the years, but something that still puzzles me about God is that I believe he is good and I believe he is for people. And then I sit with people that have more suffering in a lifetime than seems good or loving.
For me, I would say believing that God is in control. My lived experience is like really stressing out about things that are going on in the world. It's hard for me to balance those two things.
Mm. All right. The final question of the gauntlet you guys have sailed through.
Sweating.
When in your life lately have you felt most fully and completely loved?
It was probably over Christmas break when everybody's back home, all the kids, because I've got two in college right now, and we're like watching a movie or something, and everybody's on the couch and just kind of snuggling and sitting there. For me, that is a moment of just like immense gratitude and love.
I'll say ditto. That might be cheating. This is a weird answer, but we don't lead music at our church, but I'm an usher most Sundays when I'm home. And I love letting people out for communion, and people will like hit me or joke with me on the way out of the aisle. And that sense of like, oh, familiarity, I feel really happy about that.
Mm.
Not, they don't hit me hard. Like, it's not violent. It's just like, yeah. It's like they know that they can mess with me.
Being known.
Yeah. It's just like friends. It's like, oh yeah, we see each other every Sunday and I see you.
Yeah. My guests are Jill and Andy Gullihorn. They perform music together. They both also do solo work. So I'll have links in the show notes to songs of theirs that are my personal favorite. I'll have links to how you can chase their music more. Jill travels under the name Jill Phillips, her maiden name, and then practices therapy in Nashville under her married name, Jill Gullihorn. All of those links will be in the show notes. I would imagine there'd be a percentage of my audience that is not familiar with you guys. I'm excited for maybe you just spend a few extra minutes on this podcast and click around the show notes and discover some of their music. It's been an incredible balm in my life for the last 20 plus years. So Andy and Jill, thanks so much for coming on Being Human.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. We love being with you.
Yeah, we love what you're doing.
Being Human is a production of Christianity Today. It's executive produced by Eric Petrick and Mike Cosper. It's produced and edited by Matt Stevens. The associate producers are Mackenzie Hill and Ray Gilliam, with music by Dan Phelps, mix engineer Kevin Morris, and graphic design by Amy Jones.